Coming up, a message from the pulpit of Bethel Primitive Baptist Church in Calabash, North Carolina, by Elder Michael Goins. For information about Bethel Church, please visit our website at bethelpbc.us.
This morning, I direct your attention to 2 Kings chapter 3, beginning in the 16th verse. And Elisha said, "Thus saith the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. For thus saith the Lord, ye shall not see wind, neither shall ye see rain. Yet that valley shall be filled with water, that ye may drink, both ye and your cattle and your beasts. And this is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. He will deliver the Moabites also into your hand." The scene in 2 Kings chapter 3 takes place at the beginning of the ministry of Elisha the prophet. Elijah, his predecessor, has just gone home to heaven in a chariot of fire. Elisha now takes up the mantle of Elijah and continues the prophetic ministry. And Elisha, differing from Elijah, was a minister of mercy. Elijah primarily was a minister of judgment, a minister whose prophetic career was characterized by, if you please, conflict and crisis. But Elisha is frequently the instrument of God for showing mercy, for bringing blessing. It doesn't mean that Elijah brought no blessing, and it doesn't mean that Elisha had no conflict. But these are the dominant characteristics of their particular prophetic careers. The first verse of this third chapter of 2 Kings introduces us to two kings: Jehoram, who was the king over Israel, and Jehoshaphat, who was the king of Judah. Now, Jehoram was the successor to the throne of Israel after the death of his father Ahab, and no doubt you are aware that Ahab was one of the most notorious of Israel's kings. Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, was a godly king. Interestingly, when you study the kings in the Old Testament, the only godly kings were in the southern tribe of Judah. The northern kingdom had no godly kings. Every one of them, we're told, did evil in the sight of the Lord. Jehoshaphat, though, was a godly, albeit hapless, king. He did not always use the best judgment. Jehoram, on the other hand, the best thing we can say about him, the son of Ahab, is that he wasn't quite as wicked as his dad had been. Notice verse 2 of this chapter. Jehoram wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father or like his mother. For he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom. So he was an evil or wicked king, but not quite as evil, not quite as wicked, if that is indeed a compliment, as his father Ahab had been. Verse 4 introduces us to another king, the king of Moab named Misha. And Misha, we're told, was a master shepherd. The verdant pastures of Moab, like New Zealand, were conducive to raising sheep. And consequently, during Ahab's tenure on Israel's throne, the terms of the annual tribute that had been imposed on Moab, in which they were to pay to Israel, was quite heavy. You listen to verse 4, and it tells you that Misha, the king of Moab, was a sheep master. He rendered to the king of Israel 100,000 lambs. This is an annual tax or tribute. 100,000 lambs, 100,000 rams with the wool. That's quite a significant tax. But it came to pass when Ahab was dead that Misha, the king of Moab, rebelled against the king of Israel. He saw his opportunity to get out from under this excessive or exorbitant burden. And so he cuts off his tax. He says, "I'm not going to pay it anymore." This upset Jehoram, Ahab's son, and it says in verse 6, King Jehoram received this news. He went out and numbered all Israel. He gathered an army. And he went and sent to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah. The king of Israel, the wicked king, now sends down to Jehoshaphat, the godly king of Judah, saying, "The king of Moab hath rebelled against me. Wilt thou go with me against Moab to battle?" And Jehoshaphat's response is somewhat surprising. He says, "I will go up. I am as thou art, my people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses." Now, this is an unholy alliance, and it leads to a very unwise and prayerless plan, resulting in a serious crisis. You can read about that as he goes on to say, "Which way shall we go up?" And Jehoram answered, "The way through the wilderness of Edom." Now, don't look at the moment, but in a little while, turn to the back of your Bibles and look at some of the maps of ancient Israel, and you will see that to get to Moab, which was on the adjacent side of the Dead Sea, the armies of Jehoram and Jehoshaphat had to travel south. They had to circle around the bottom side of the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea through a very sterile land, a very desert land, and then come up through to the verdant pastures of Moab. So this was the battle tactic, the surprise assault, and Jehoram decides that they can pick up the king of Edom and his army, so you'll have three kings, the king of Israel, the king of Judah, and the king of Edom, all joining in a league against the Moabites. They're going to attack them. But notice there's no hint or mention in this narrative that they have inquired of the Lord. They haven't prayed. They haven't asked God's wisdom or direction or guidance or sought his blessing. This is a decision that Jehoram has made, and Jehoshaphat unwisely, haplessly, decides that he's going to join forces with Jehoram. Now, this isn't the first time godly King Jehoshaphat has made such an error in judgment. He had a good heart, but he didn't always use the best judgment. You know, some of us have probably repeated that same error in our lives. In 1 Kings chapter 22, I should have said, Jehoshaphat makes an alliance with Jehoram's father, Ahab, and he goes into battle against him. And on that occasion, Jehoshaphat was almost killed. In fact, Ahab was slain in that battle. Jehoshaphat now repeats the same mistake, and he uses identical language. "I am as thou art, my people are as thy people." He makes an alliance with the wicked king of Israel. And by the way, there's a very important practical lesson here, and it is simply this: evil communications corrupt good manners. The Bible tells us in the book of Proverbs that he that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. And it's vitally important that we be careful with whom we make an alliance. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 exhorts us to make no friendship with this world. For what communion hath light with darkness? What concord hath Christ with Baal? What agreement hath the temple of God with idols? We're not to be unequally yoked, whether it's in a business partnership, whether it's in marriage, whether it's in a friendship. We need to be careful about the friends that we choose. Wisdom demands that we recognize that everyone with whom we come into contact has an influence on us. And so Jehoshaphat, though a godly man, he had a good heart, didn't always use the best kind of wisdom. He didn't always use good judgment. And on this occasion, he makes another unholy alliance that could have been destructive. In fact, like the former one with his father Ahab, Jehoram's father, this one was almost disastrous in the career of Jehoshaphat. I want to note three important lessons from this passage. I've tried to give you the background story. First of all, I want us to speak first about the weakness of our flesh. Then we'll talk about the expectation of our faith. And finally, about the deliverance of our King. First, notice the weakness of our flesh, verse 9. So the king of Israel went, and the king of Judah, and the king of Edom. And they fetched a compass of 7 days' journey, and here's the crisis. And there was no water for the host, or for the cattle that followed them. So perhaps they had horses, maybe some camels, but they had no water. Now what happens to three armies? The army of the king of Israel, the army of the king of Judah, and the army of the king of Edom, when they reach a place where they have no water. Well, may I say that something as small as the lack of drinking water would be enough to debilitate an entire army. It could completely derail the entire military campaign. They had no water to drink, especially as they're walking on the south end of the Dead Sea, going toward Moab. They've been on this journey, and they've forgotten to bring water, and there's no water available to them. And the king of Israel said, "Alas, that the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." Now, strangely, he blames the Lord. This man, you may remember, hadn't even sought the Lord. He hadn't asked direction from the Lord when the plan was hatched. He hadn't asked the Lord to guide him. He hadn't sought the Lord's blessing. But now when trouble comes, he criticizes and blames the Lord. Jehoram panics, and he blames the Lord for his perilous circumstances in which they found themselves. Isn't that par for the course for this fallen, sinful world? He criticizes God for his trials, but yet he would have credited man for his triumphs. That's the way the world operates. I was interested this past week to hear a governor of one of our states that has suffered tremendous damage during this COVID-19 crisis. I think what he said sort of encapsulates the spirit of secularism, the spirit of humanism, the attitude of the world that blames the Lord for troubles but credits man for successes. The governor said the number of cases is down because we brought it down. He said God did not do that. A chill went up my spine when I heard that. He said faith did not do that. A lot of pain and suffering did that. That's how it works. It's math. I want to say such an audacious statement is nothing but pure and unadulterated secularism. It reminds me of the alleged proud boast of the anonymous employee when the SMS Titanic launched and he said even God couldn't sink this ship. And I wanted to ask the governor, if I'd had his ear, the question, "Dost thou not fear God? God didn't do this. Faith didn't do this. We did it." That's how the world operates. It criticizes God for crisis. It panics in the face of crisis and blames the Lord for peril and danger, but yet it credits man for any success. But I want you to notice how weak our flesh is. For something as small as the lack of a little drinking water was enough to bring this whole military campaign to its knees. They had no water. He didn't say that superior weaponry among the enemy brought them down. It doesn't say that a better tactical campaign or strategic military plan from the enemy is what jeopardized the success of this mission. It was simply something as small as the lack of water. And the king of Israel begins to panic. You know, nothing like a parched throat and a grumbling belly to be able to start saying, "The Lord has delivered us into the hand of Moab. The Lord brought these three kings together." No, this was Jehoram's plan. The Lord did not cause this trouble. Man caused this trouble. But notice how weak they were. And I want to say I've thought about that in recent days. You know, modern man likes to thumb his lapels and boast about how that he is invincible, how he can solve any problem. We're the greatest, we're the champions of the world. But you know, a little microscopic, invisible virus has brought our economy to a screeching halt. It shut down the country. In fact, the whole world has suffered by a little invisible microscopic virus. And one of the lessons I think we need to learn from this, dear friends, is what Isaiah chapter 40, verse 6 says, "All flesh is grass, and the glory of man is like the flower of the field. The grass withereth and the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever." Notice he didn't say that people are like sequoia trees. He didn't say that we are strong and invincible, but he says we're just like the grass of the field that blooms today, the little daylily that blooms today and fades tomorrow. The fading glory of man. You know, my life is a testimony to the fading glory of man. My mind isn't as sharp, my voice isn't as resonant, my body is not as physically fit and strong as it once was. It doesn't take long after we've climbed to the peak or the apex of our abilities in life before we begin the downhill grade. It happens to all of us, doesn't it? And it happens quickly. We're like the little flower of the field that blooms today and it wilts tomorrow. The fading glory of man, the weakness of our flesh. How we need to learn this. How utterly weak and vulnerable is man, and how brief and uncertain is our life. The hymn writer put it well when he says, "Frail children of dust and feeble as frail." That's our condition. We're frail children of the dust, and we are feeble and frail. Verse 11 and following says, "But Jehoshaphat said," when the king of Israel panics and says, "Alas, the Lord has brought these three kings together to deliver us into the hand of Moab." Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not here a prophet of the Lord?" He knew that we need to seek the Lord. Perhaps at this point, his conscience is beginning to haunt him, to hurt him. And he thinks, one thing we've forgotten here, we forgot to seek the guidance of God. So he says, "Isn't there a prophet anywhere around that we can consult, that we can seek the Lord's will?" And one of the king of Israel's servants said, "Here's Elisha, the son of Shaphat, which poured water on the hands of Elijah." Elisha has spent his early career doing the menial tasks of pouring water on the hands of Elijah. He's Elijah's assistant. Now the man that has proven himself faithful in that which is least, God has elevated him to a position of greater influence. And now is his time to take center stage. And Elisha, when he's called, says to the king of Israel, very curtly, "What have I to do with thee?" Now, I said Elisha was a minister of mercy. That's the dominant tone of his prophetic career. But yet that doesn't mean he lacked a backbone. It doesn't mean that he didn't speak the truth when he needed to. He says to the king of Israel, "What have I to do with thee? Why are you seeking me?" He says, "Go to the prophets of your father and your mother." And the king of Israel said, "Nay, for the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." And Elisha responds, "If Jehoshaphat was not here, a man whom I respect and regard as a godly man, then I wouldn't even listen to you. I would not look toward thee nor see thee." But Elisha says, "Bring me now a minstrel." Before he says anything too much in the heat of his holy anger, his righteous indignation, Elisha says, "Bring me someone who can play on the harp. I need to calm down." And while the minstrel plays on the harp, Elisha begins to seek the Lord in prayer. And it says, the hand of the Lord came upon him. And here we come to our text. And Elisha said, "Thus saith the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. They have no water." The army, the three armies of these three different nations, Israel, Judah, and Edom, on their way to Moab, are about to die of thirst. But the Lord says, "Start digging ditches. Make this valley full of ditches. For thus saith the Lord," here's Elisha's message, "ye shall not see wind, neither shall ye see rain. Yet the valley shall be filled with water, that you may drink, both ye and your cattle and your beasts." And this is but a light thing to the Lord. Jehovah doesn't have to expend any great effort in order to accomplish this. This is easy in the sight of the Lord. He's going to go even beyond that. He's going to deliver the Moabites into your hand. We've talked about the weakness of our flesh. Let's talk about the expectation of our faith now. Make this valley full of ditches. You say, "Preacher, it hadn't rained. There was no water." What good is digging in the sand going to do? Why would they dig ditches, reservoirs, to hold water when there was no water to be found there in the desert, at the base of the Salt Sea? Well, because, dear friends, faith puts its object not in circumstances, but in the God who gives the promise. It is a fact that faith is no stronger than its object. Somebody says you just have to believe in yourself. I want to say that wouldn't have helped Jonah very much in the whale's belly. Jonah would not have seen his situation resolved by looking within and unleashing his untapped human potential. No, there's no believing in yourself, lifting yourself by the bootstraps, that's going to help Jonah in the whale's belly. Somebody might have said, well, let's just think positively. That's having faith in your faith. This isn't a matter of just positive thinking, just the I think I can, I think I can, I think I can sort of approach to life. Faith, my friends, is no better than the object in which it is placed. The object of our faith is not ourselves, it's not our circumstances, it's our God. Make this valley full of ditches. You say, why should we do that? There's no evidence around that water is forthcoming. But you see, the God who gives the promise is capable of resolving the crisis. And the object of our faith is the true and living God. You see, our God is the God Abraham trusted. I love Romans chapter 4, verse 17, where it says of Abraham, he believed in God, the God who quickeneth the dead, that is, the God who can raise the dead to life. Watch this. And calleth those things which be not as though they were. Now, what is the sentiment of Elisha's counsel on this occasion? Make this valley full of ditches. He's calling things that be not as though they were. In preparation for the blessing, he's saying, start digging ditches because God's going to resolve your crisis. He's going to solve this problem. And faith, because it trusts God, calls things that be not as though they were. Psalm 62:5 is a wonderful verse. It's meant so much to me over the years, as the psalmist David says, my soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from him. I want to say that one of the reasons you and I lose heart and we sink in discouragement and we lose our way in this world is because we put our expectation in other people. We say, you're not living up to my expectations. You've let me down. I was depending on you. I was looking forward to this happening. We put our expectation in circumstances or in other people. My friends, may we be able to say with the psalmist, my expectation only is in the Lord. Faith's expectation, our expectation of the blessing that we need, is rooted in the object of our faith, which is the true and living God. What I'm saying, my beloved, is there's a fourth king on the scene in this historical narrative. You've got the king of Israel, the king of Judah, and the king of Edom. There's a fourth king on the scene here. You know who it is? It's the one described in Psalm 95, verse 3, when it says, for the Lord is a great God, and he is a great king. You see, when your faith is in the great king, not the king of Israel, not even the king of Judah, or certainly not the king of Edom, but it's in the God who says, make this valley full of ditches, and he calls those things that be not as though they were, then I dare say it's time to get busy digging in the dirt, digging in the sand, making the reservoirs, because a blessing is forthcoming. Someone once said, expect great things from a great God. That's the attitude of faith. Faith says, I expect great things. Now, perhaps you're listening today and you say, preacher, I've long ago given up any hope. I've been burned so many times. I've had my hopes raised only to be dashed before my eyes that I've long since ceased to hope for a brighter day. Who was it? The nihilist Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, stop hoping. It hurts too much. And indeed, dear friends, that's the attitude of this secular world system in which we live. But the poet put it so well when he says, thou art coming to a king, great petitions with thee bring. For his grace and power are such that none can ever ask too much. When you go to God, my friends, in prayer, it's important that you and I not aim lowly, but that we aim high, that we dare to ask great things. Faith dares to ask for great blessings from God. Jeremiah 31 verse 3 says, "Call unto me and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not." Indeed, my beloved, God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that you can ask or think. And in this day of crisis, you say, "Preacher, I don't see anything getting better. It just looks like everything's getting worse. Looks like the economy has tanked. America's going bankrupt. I'm going bankrupt. I'm jobless. I'm afraid. I'm struggling with these uncertainties. I don't know what to do. I'm afraid not only for the physical potential of physical disease, but I'm afraid of what is happening to our country. I'm afraid that our freedoms are being taken away. And preacher, I don't know what to do." My friends, may I encourage you today to cast your eyes back to the God who is the great King. And you're coming to a King in prayer. Therefore, great petitions with you bring. For his grace and power are such that none can ever ask too much. "Call unto me and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not." You see, we've talked about the weakness of our flesh, how a little problem like the lack of water or a microscopic virus can bring us to a standstill. But now we're talking about the expectation of our faith. Our expectation is in him. We're looking to him to solve our problems. Make this valley full of ditches. You say, what good's that going to do? You've got a great God. This is the language of faith. Reminds me of that promise in Isaiah chapter 54, verse 2, when the Lord says to his people, "Enlarge the place of thy tent." Now, of course, Isaiah was a prophet before the Babylonian captivity. Somebody says, "Why should we build on to our house?" That doesn't make any sense. You say we're going into captivity, we're going to be gone for 70 years. Why should we enlarge the place of our abode, of our tent? He says, well, enlarge it, build on. "Let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation. Spare not, don't hold back. Lengthen thy cords and strengthen thy stakes." Watch the promise. "For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame, for thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood anymore." God says, even as they're going, the nation is going into bondage for 70 years, don't be afraid. Build on, because God is going to cause you to break forth on the right hand and on the left. You see, faith sees the things that are not as though they were. I'm not talking about positive thinking. I'm not talking about wild, vain imagination. I'm talking about trusting in the living God, who is our great King. Faith prepares for the blessing because it acts on the promise of the God who cannot lie, who has never deceived his children, and he's sure not going to break a record like that at this late date in human history. I love that verse in Isaiah chapter 45. Verse number 18, where he says, "God created the earth. He formed it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is none else. I said not unto the seed of Jacob, seek ye me in vain." When God promises something, my friends, it's not an empty promise. "I said not, seek ye me." I didn't say that in vain. For he says, "I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right." If he's made a promise in his word, you can depend on it. You can carry it to the bank because the Lord never lies to his children. He never breaks his promise. And faith, therefore, steps out on the promise of God. Like the priest who stepped out on the Jordan. You see, that water did not part until what? Until the sole of the priest's foot touched the water. He's stepping out and his foot touches the water and then the water parts. And that, my friends, is faith. Make this valley full of ditches. This spirit of expectation should mark every believer's attitude toward our lives as we look at the future. Do you have it in your heart today, my beloved? I love the imagery of Psalm 81, verse 10, where the Lord says, "Open thy mouth wide, and I will fill it." In my mind's eye, I picture a nest of little birds whose mouths are open as the mother returns to the nest with something to eat. Now, only one little bird will receive the worm, but the others' mouths are open. They're expectant. And when we come to the Lord in prayer, my friends, we need to come expectantly, not doubting, not, I just don't really think this will work, but what can prayer hurt? No, but we should come trusting that He doesn't promise us in vain. He doesn't call upon us to seek His face in vain. That's not an empty promise. When the Lord says that He will take care of us, when He says He will bless us, faith takes God at His word. C.H. Spurgeon once said, the best hold that faith can get on God is taking Him at His word. So God says to you and me, open your mouth wide. Open your mouth in prayer, little child of God, and dare to ask great things from a great King. For God is able to supply your needs and then some. And then open your mouth in praise when the blessing comes, and in thanksgiving, giving glory to the God, not to yourself, not saying God didn't do this, faith didn't do this, but we did this. No, my friends, may I say, if there's a fault, the fault belongs to us. The blame can rest right here. It was the fault of the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat's lack of judgment that they were in the fix that they were in. But I'll tell you, the Lord had mercy upon them even in their hour of crisis. And how many times has He had mercy on you and me in our hour of crisis? And that brings us finally this morning. We've talked about the weakness of our flesh, how a little germ can bring us to our knees. We've talked about the expectation of our faith. I want you to notice the deliverance of our King. Verse 17, for thus saith the Lord, ye shall not see wind nor rain, yet the valley shall be filled with water that you may drink, both ye and your cattle and your beasts. First thing I want you to notice here is that the Lord works sovereignly. Somebody says, well, if God's going to fill these ditches with water, then surely it's going to come like it did last time. You remember when Elijah had lived through the drought. He said, I hear a sound of an abundance of rain. He saw a cloud which was the size of a man's hand on the horizon. And he said, it's about to rain. And sure enough, the clouds grew. And before you know it, a real old-time gully washer came. That's how God resolved the drought and the crisis in that day. You say, well, He's going to do that again. That's the only way He can work. I believe God often does things differently than we expect just to show us that He's in charge and we're not. And His resources are unlimited. He owns the gold of Ophir and the cattle on 1,000 hills, and nothing is too hard for our God. Now, I can't explain how it happened on this occasion, but God said it's not going to come through rain from heaven. The water will not come through the blowing of wind. It's not a storm that's going to blow through. You say, how did the water come on this occasion, preacher? Well, it says, verse 20, and it came to pass in the morning when the meat offering was offered, behold, there came water by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. It just started flowing like a river. You ask, where did it come from? I have no idea. God sent it. But yet He solved the crisis. It was a miracle. It was a supernatural display of God's mighty power. My beloved, the Lord works sovereignly to deliver His people, and sometimes He'll do it in a way that is diametrically opposite to what you were expecting, just to show you that He's not strapped or limited in His resources. Then notice, not only does He work sovereignly, but He works abundantly. For it says, the valley shall be filled with water. Not just a little canteen of water, but these reservoirs that you've dug into the sand are going to be filled with water to overflowing. You're going to drink of it. Your cattle, your beasts will drink. And it says that the whole country, verse 20, was filled with water. And then I love the words of verse 18, and this is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. Oh, my friends, God's power is not strapped. It's an easy thing for Him to resolve your crisis and mine. The problem we face in our country, you say, it's so complex. I don't know what to believe, what to disbelieve. I don't know which way to go. It's so challenging, preacher. I'm perplexed by it all. I'm telling you, it doesn't stress the Lord in the least. It's a light thing to the Lord. He's able to save by many or by few. Where's your trust today? Is it in the president? Is it in the commission? Is it in the governor? Is it in the mayor? Is it in yourself? My beloved, our trust should be in the living God. He's the only one who can help us. He's our King. He's our great King. When he works abundantly. You say, well, preacher, how did this story conclude? It says, when all the Moabites heard that the kings were come up to fight against them, they gathered all that put on armor and upward, and they stood in the border. So somehow the news reaches them that a military coalition, is on its way to Moab. You say, why is this happening again? Remember, the king of Moab has rebelled against the king of Israel, and he's not going to pay his tax that he's paid for years, his annual tax. And king of Israel is going to show him who's boss. So the Lord says, I'm about to send a great blessing. So the Moabites heard that this coalition of military forces has come to Moab. So they prepare themselves for the battle. It says they rose up early in the morning. And when they looked toward the south, the sun shone on the water. And the Moabites saw this water as red as blood. Perhaps the way the sun was hitting it or whatever, but they concluded that there had been a mutiny among the armies and they had fallen on each other, and the kings were surely slain. They said, this is blood. The kings are surely slain and they have smitten one another. Now therefore Moab to the spoils. Let's go down and clean up. Let's gather what we can of what they've left behind. The victory's already ours. And they ran with great excitement down to gather the booty from the battle. And it says when they came to the camp, the Israelites rose up and smote the Moabites so that they fled before them. The armies chased them even into the country. They beat down the cities, and on every good piece of land, they cast every man his stone. And they stopped up the wells of water, felled all the good trees. I'll tell you, the Lord worked abundantly. He not only satisfied their need for water, he defeated their enemy. He rewards faith in a bountiful way. He goes above and beyond what you've even expected. As Ephesians 3:20 says, that he does exceeding abundantly above. Notice, the apostle just stacks adverb on top of adverb. He does above all that you can ask or think. You say, I can ask for some pretty big blessings, preacher. God can do above that. Not only that, he can do abundantly above that. And not only that, he can do in excess of abundantly above. He does exceeding abundantly above all that you can ask or think. Indeed, my beloved, our God is great. One of the examples that illustrates that principle is in Luke chapter 5, when Peter and the disciples are fishing and they've toiled all night and caught nothing. Jesus says to them, cast your net on the right side. And when they did that, they caught such a great catch of fish that the net broke. Yes, my friends, Peter, who was an experienced fisherman, might have said, Lord, I'm a professional fisherman. You're not. I've done this my whole life. Experience has taught me that when you've had a night of fishing like this, the best thing to do is to close shop and go home. But Peter says, Lord, even though we've toiled all night and caught nothing, circumstances argue against obeying your command. Yet, nevertheless, he says, at thy word, I will cast down the net. And when he did, the blessing was so abundant, he couldn't even contain it. You know, that's the language of faith. Lord, circumstances argue against doing what you've said. Nevertheless, at your word, I'm going to do what you've said. And when we do that, Malachi 3:10 says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse. That's God's exhortation to you and me. And he says, and see if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Isn't that the story of your life, dear friends? God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that you can ask or think. This is faith's reward. Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is. He's real. And that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. I ask you today, dear friends, are you in the valley of adversity and extremity, lacking the nourishment that you need? Faith calls upon you and me in our hours of crisis to look away from our abject need, to fix our eyes in expectation on our great King, and to begin digging ditches in preparation for his abundant provision, calling upon him for his divine aid and expecting that the one who never once bid his people to seek him in vain will indeed respond with a blessing that is exceeding abundantly above what you might even imagine is possible. Do you trust him today, my friend? He would say to you and to me, as you look at the future, as I look at the future, according to your faith, be it unto you. May we trust in the living God, our great King, as we look toward the future this morning.
Faith is the bride.